Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
And I'm Aaron Mattek. How are you, Katie?
It's hot. It's very hot.
It's hot. It's cooking, but not as hot as it is over for our friends in Europe.
Over the pond, yeah.
It's tough right now. Yeah.
It's really tough right now. People are just dying. Yeah. That's the world we live in.
Yeah. And being in a proxy war with one of the world's top energy producers also isn't helping either, because now countries in Europe have to ration energy and limit cooling and limit gas consumption. So great timing for a proxy war, always.
It's great. Yeah. I mean, it's always a great time for proxy war, but it's even especially good right now.
Yeah. So and just wait till winter comes. It's going to be even better.
Well, at least people won't die of heat. They'll just maybe die of hypothermia.
There we go. Yeah.
God, this is such a dark world we're living in.
It is. Well, we're here to lighten it up with this week's four food groups.
Yep, four basic food groups. So for this week's four basic food groups, we got I got Democrats suck. So this is an interesting curveball, because you're going to be like, why is this a Democrat suck? This sounds like Republicans suck. So let me just start. Reading from Democracy Now. Voters went to the polls Tuesday for a primary election in Maryland. The Trump-backed far-right state legislator Dan Cox won the Republican gubernatorial primary. Last year, Cox helped organize buses to Washington on January 6 when he called Vice President Mike Pence a traitor for not supporting Trump's effort to overturn the election. If elected, Cox has vowed to conduct a forensic audit of the 2020 election. He also wants to ban abortion in Maryland and end what he describes as sexual indoctrination in schools. Now, why is this a Democrat suck? Because the Democratic Governors Association spent over $1 million helping elevate Cox's message as part of an effort to help the primary campaigns of far-right candidates that Democrats hope will be more vulnerable in the November general election. This is called the Pied Piper strategy.
Because the idea is to get Republican followers to follow the Pied Piper, which will then lead them to destruction.
Right. Now, you may have heard of this before. This happened in a minor election, which didn't have that much of a consequence when you think about it on a global scale. If you really zoom up, take a real bird's eye view from another planet, which was, of course, Donald Trump. And the Democrats also encouraged his rise during the primary because they thought he was such a joke and so repulsive and so odious that he would, of course, help the Democrats get into office. Now, newsflash, that didn't work. It got Donald Trump elected.
Didn't work. They were so into it, though, that Bill Clinton even called Donald Trump reportedly to encourage him personally to run, because they were friends at that point.
Right, right. They'd gone to weddings together. Yeah.
Exactly. With Jeffrey Epstein and all, and that whole crew. So, yeah, Bill Clinton used his personal connection to encourage Trump to run, and that got them Trump humiliating them in 2016. So great job to try that again. I'm sure that's
going to work. Yeah, great job to try that again. Yeah, they definitely got the memo on from that experience. They're doing it also in Pennsylvania with Mastriano, who's another right-wing lunatic. So maybe he'll get in too, and we'll have a bunch of them. Fingers crossed, right, Dems? So what do we got for Republican suck?
So for Republican suck, we have one of Republicans' top passions, which is banning abortion. And also cutting back on Medicaid. So we're combining two passions of Republicans here. This is a headline in the San Antonio Current. It says, Texas officials celebrated end of abortion rights after cutting back postpartum Medicaid extension. The article says, while celebrating last month's Supreme Court decision overturning the right to an abortion, Governor Greg Abbott pointed to the millions of dollars in spending that state lawmakers approved to help pregnant women and new mothers. Among the measures he touted was a law that extended Medicaid health care coverage for a pregnant woman until 6 months after they give birth or miscarry, exceeding the federal government's requirement that states provide at least 2 months of the benefit. Abbott's statement neglected to mention that Texas lags behind at least 33 states, including 11 led by Republicans, all of which have already expanded or are working with the federal government to extend postpartum Medicaid benefits for a full year after giving birth. So basically, Abbott is bragging about how he's going to be there to support pregnant mothers after forcing mothers to carry the fetus to term, all while cutting back the number of the months of benefits that they get to have that pregnancy. So many other states get 12 months. Abbott is saying, let's just give them 6 months and then they can fend for themselves.
I feel like, Aaron, you didn't do justice to this great Republican pastime, because you did say that they like blocking access to abortion. So they do like taking away women's right to choose. And then I think you said that they like cutting. What did you say? They like cutting benefits in general?
Yeah.
Well, you know what they really like doing, though, on top of that, is they like cutting benefits to babies as soon as they're born.
That's right.
Grace period of 6 months. You know, I guess they want to give them 6 months. But this is such a beautiful, like, you can't make this up. They really care. They're very pro-life when it's not a viable human being. But once it's born, not so much.
Yeah, you're on your own.
Then you got to fend for yourself. Yeah,
exactly. And this article also points out that Texas is among a dozen states that have also declined to expand broader Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act to additional people with low incomes, leaving it with some of the strictest eligibility requirements in the country. For example, single parents with one child must earn $196 or less a month to qualify.
Holy fuck. $196 or less a month?
To qualify. Yeah, for healthcare. If you make above that, sorry, you can't.
If you make $200 a month, you're rolling in dough. You don't need any help.
You're out. Yeah, no healthcare for you.
These people are such sadists.
Yeah.
Disgusting. I would love to do a brain scan on them to see what happens in their brain when they're doing this stuff.
They probably derive some glee. This is what they live for.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway, good candidate, though, for Republican suck.
Great candidate. I mean, the good news is that we had such a great candidate. So that we can look on the bright side. Thank you, Republicans, for making our job so easy. Yeah.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
Judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
So for Isn't That Weird, we have a story reading at the Wall Street Journal, final DIY project, build your own coffin. For people who want to make their own final resting place, merchants offer ready to assemble kits. We just had so much fun. Visitors to Leona Oceana's home near Portland, Maine might notice the pine bookshelves perched in one corner of her living room. Garlanded by white lights, the shelves hold neat rows of books by her favorite authors, including Mark Twain and Edward Gorey, along with knickknacks such as a snow globe with a skull inside. Guests tend to check out, says Miss Oceana, 52 years old and administrator at a municipal public works department. Visitors may not immediately grasp the versatility of the bookcase. It might look like it came from IKEA, but it will eventually be a coffin. The shelves are designed to be removed easily, and one day the two sections of this bookcase are to be joined with hinges to serve as Ms. Oceana's final resting place. To prepare for the inevitable, some people lay out instructions for their funerals or write their own obituaries. Then there are the other souls, including Ms. Oceana, who build their own coffins and use them as part of their household decor until needed. Death has always intrigued me. I don't think in a weird way, she says. Now, she's not the only person, Aaron, and viewers and listeners, to do this. Various merchants offer coffin parts or ready-to-assemble kits to make the task easier. Northwoods Casket Company of Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, sells a build-your-own casket kit, starting at $6.99. Pretty affordable, honestly. Jonas Azan, owner of Northwoods Casket, says the company sells about 5 kits in a typical month. The company's website says its assembly takes 1 to 2 hours, and it features a blog post called, "So You Want to Build a Casket?" And buyers can add their own flourishes and creative designs. I've seen a lot of camouflage, Mr. Zahn says. Those in the DIY coffin camp give a range of reasons for taking matters into their own hands. Preparing for death may increase the odds of checking out in a pleasant manner. Having a burial box standing by perhaps means less trouble for the surviving family members, and it might be easier on the budget than buying a commercially made coffin. And you can see these beautiful bookcases, which I guess somehow will turn into a casket. Do you see that little cute skeleton, by the way?
Gorgeous.
Gorgeous skeleton.
Yeah. I'll say this. That's the happiest skeleton I've seen in a long time.
The skull, not so much. The skull looks a little down.
It's tough to be a happy skull.
It's tough to be a happy skull. When you're separated from your body, you're not as happy. When you're Fair with enough. Your body, when the full skeleton is present, it's a lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
Then we see someone else lying in a bookshelf. Joan Pillsbury climbed into her coffin to get a better angle for her drill. So what do you think of this, Aaron?
It makes sense if you want a coffin. My only question is, though, should you want a coffin? Wouldn't the best thing for everybody, for your friends and family, in terms of a hardship on them and for the planet, just to get cremated?
I guess so. You could do a green burial. That's a thing, apparently. But cremated. Yeah, that's yeah, cremated. Who was I talking about this? What are your thoughts on what should be done with the ashes? I mean, obviously, it's up to the person. But are you in favor of scattering them or putting them in some kind of urn?
I think that's up to the individual.
All right.
But I think those ceremonies where people go and they scatter the ashes, especially in a place that's significant to that person's life, I think those are really beautiful things. You're returning them to the earth.
Right.
I find those moments very touching. That's what I'm going to do.
Right, we do.
But
are you?
Yeah.
You're going to have that done?
Yeah, I just don't want to take up space as a cadaver. Right. You know, but that's my own. Hey, everyone's got their own preference.
No, we're not coffin shaming.
We're not coffin shaming. No.
Yeah. At least not too strongly.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So that's that. That's the, isn't that weird?
That's a very, very good weird. All right. So for isn't that terrible, we have an incident from the world of fast food, which, you know, how many horror stories has the fast food industry provided us? Well, here's the latest one. Mom claims traumatized daughter found cigarette in Burger King fries.
Traumatic.
Well, if you think it's traumatic now, Katie, let's watch the video.
Oh my gosh. Oh my goodness.
As you see, it's from Burger King. Sorry, it's a little greasy, but you can see there were chicken fries ordered. And after eating six, as you see, we found a cigarette butt.
Oh my gosh.
Put some light on it. It is a Seneca menthol that my daughter found half smoked in her bag.
Wow. That is terrible indeed. I mean, it's understandable because I got to say that cigarette looked a lot like the chicken fry in terms of the color.
It did look very similar. It's an easy mistake to make.
I mean, it's probably happened to the best of us.
Yeah. And let's face it, you know, Burger King, they're not known for their fries.
Ah, interesting.
They're known for their Whoppers.
Right.
The Whopper is really their signature dish. I think people generally elevate Wendy's and McDonald's fries over Burger King's. And so maybe it's really the fault of the consumer here for ordering the fries, knowing that they're not getting a top product and things like this are going to happen.
Right. Yeah, it's true. Like, if you're not going to order the best of the best, be prepared to eat a cigarette.
Exactly.
I thought you were going to say that people who order from Burger King are eating unhealthily. And so what's a cigarette here or there? But you're actually saying it's not a question of the health. You're saying it's a question of how top notch the cuisine is. I respect
that.
Yeah,
I mean, if you're, you know,
that's not health shaming. That's different. Yeah.
I just feel like in the hierarchy of fast food fries, that Burger King is not up there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think we're getting a little bit into victim blaming territory, but you know what? You got to check. The first step in preventing that is being aware of it. So I think we're also showing people what victim blaming looks like so that they know not to do it.
Well, look, no matter how you feel about Burger King fries, let's all agree that a cigarette butt inside the fries is terrible. Hence, that was this week's Isn't That Terrible.
So what's new? Anything else on your mind, Aaron?
Well, let me just shout out the squad for voting for a new measure to expand NATO, adding Sweden and Finland, which is great news for the military-industrial complex, which is even given a shout out in this bill. Let me show the text. So this measure, which will expand NATO, open up a new NATO front, really, on Russia's borders via Finland, also has this passage where, quote, it urges all members of NATO to meet the 2% defense spending pledge as agreed upon during the 2014 Wales summit. And what that is at this summit, all NATO member states pledged to ensure that they spend at least 2% of their GDP on the military industrial complex. And so this is the squad and every other progressive member of Congress voting to urge NATO members to meet that pledge. Make sure you spend at least 2% of your GDP on the military industrial complex. And I can tell you one person who will be very happy with that pledge. Here he is.
We expect a growing number of nations to meet the minimum 2% of GDP requirement. To address today's challenges, all members of the alliance must fulfill their obligations. They have no choice. They must fulfill their obligations.
So there you go. There is one, at least one guy who will be very happy that Democrats are making sure that all NATO member states spend 2% of their GDP on the military. His name is Donald J. Trump.
It sounds like almost like the way that you're saying it, it almost sounds like a telethon. Like we need to raise these funds. We can't do it without you.
We urge you. Yes, we urge you. Yes, it's really important that everyone spends at least 2% of their GDP on the military industrial complex. We can't be feeding people, giving them health care, building infrastructure. Right. Got to make sure at least 2% goes to the defense industry.
And what do you get for that? You got a beautiful NATO tote bag. Just so people understand, why is this dangerous? What's happening right now?
Well, look, we're more than 4 months into a war in Ukraine that is wreaking havoc, especially for Ukrainians. And it's also causing a crisis around the world. Food prices have skyrocketed. Nuclear tensions are escalating. There's no nuclear talks right now between the US and Russia on renewing the treaties that limit the nuclear weapons stockpiles. We have an energy crisis. Europe is facing the brunt of that. So is Africa and Asia. And we have domestic problems at home that are very, very dire. And instead, Democrats so far have been 100% behind Biden's policy. Ro Khanna recently said one thing, like, what's the plan on the diplomatic front? There is no plan. The US won't even talk to Russia about ending this war. And by voting to expand NATO and to encourage spending on NATO, aka the arms industry, Democrats are just fueling this fire and trying to speed up the race to extinction.
Yeah, well, it's going well. That's the good news, is that they're right on schedule. All righty. Anything else you want to tell us about?
Well, I do have an update on a story we discussed a few weeks ago, where the Guardian newspaper came out with this article calling me the most prolific spreader of disinformation on Syria and failing to provide any examples of this alleged disinformation or evidence. And so since then, I contacted the reporter who wrote the story. His name is Mark Townsend of The Guardian, because I wanted to see if he had any evidence. I also wanted to see why, before he printed that, why he didn't contact me first. So I actually reached him on the phone, and I had the video, which I published on my podcast, Pushback. And we have a clip of it here, so let's take a look.
To hear Aaron's call with Mark Townsend, go to usefulidiots.substack.com. All right, well, we have a great interview for you guys today. We are making history. It is our first interview with a Tony Award-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning artist named Michael Jackson. Michael R. Jackson.
Yes, Michael R. Jackson is the Tony and Pulitzer-winning playwright, composer, and lyricist of the hit Broadway musical A Strange Loop, and we're very excited to speak to him.
Aaron, what are some of your favorite songs from A Strange Loop?
As I said, I've been listening to A Strange Loop on loop, so I have a lot. The opening song, Intermission Song, is amazing. It's like a total classic American Broadway number, but it's also incredibly subversive, the way Michael adds in all these different elements and refrains.
Big black and queer as American Broadway.
Big black and queer as American Broadway. Big black and queer as American Broadway.
The next song is called Today, which I love as well. The next song after that is called We Want to Know, which is Usher's family singing to him about what's going on with his life. And it's beautiful and it's funny too.
What's going on in New York?
And then the big hit from the show is Inner White Girl.
Yeah, it's great. It's
really, which is really a great song. And the song I talked about called Periodically, which is Usher's mother confronting him about her bigotry. I mean, she's homophobic, and she's telling him how upset she is about his gay lifestyle. But Michael gives her such a beautiful melody. So even as she's saying these hateful, bigoted words, it sounds so beautiful. And it's very emotional, because at the end of it, Usher and the mother, they sing together, and they sing her, like, her bigoted words. And so he's doing a duet with her. So it's just really beautiful. And there's also a song called Memory Song.
That's one of my favorites.
Oh, it's so touching. And I mean, it's a genius show. And I hope everyone who has the opportunity can go see it. Yeah. It's just incredible.
Welcome, Michael R. Jackson. So excited to be talking to you.
Love talking to you guys.
So I know you've been asked this so many times, but tell us about the evolution of A Strange Loop, why you wrote it in the first place, and how it got to be the award-winning musical that it is today.
It started off as a monologue that I started writing right after I graduated from undergrad. I was about 23 years old, and I, you know, was sort of scared about my future. I had just had a BFA in playwriting. I didn't know what I was going to do with that. And so I started writing this monologue about a young Black gay man sort of walking around New York, wondering why life was so terrible. And it was called Why I Can't Get Work. It was just like sort of a thinly veiled personal monologue that I just wrote kind of as a way of making sense of things. The world was sort of in a crazy place at that time. Like the US was about to go to war with Iraq. I was living in the middle of nowhere, Jamaica, Queens. I had this BFA degree. I just needed something to make me feel like I had some control over something. And so I started writing this piece. And then I went to grad school about 9 months later. And I began writing music while I was there. And then the music started to work its way into the monologue. The monologue started to take shape into a one-man show that I performed. Then I decided I didn't want it to be a one-man show. Then I kept working on the book of it, the sort of story. And then that is when it sort of turned into what is now known as A Strange Loop. And then I sort of kept working on that and doing different readings and workshops over the years and concerts of music from the show. And then eventually we got our off-Broadway production in 2019. And then we did really well with that. Then the pandemic came and we were on pause, but then I won the Pulitzer in the midst of that. And then we did the show a pre-Broadway tryout in DC at the William Mammoth Theater Company. And then we got our Broadway theater in December of 2021. And then we opened on Broadway in April of 22. So that was about 18 years from start to Broadway of just sort of like working on it and working on it and working on it.
And during this period, a lot of the cast members that are in the current production, they've been working with you on the show as a part of it for throughout this period, right?
Yeah, John Andrew Morrison, who was nominated for Tony for Best Featured Actor this year, has been singing the song periodically from the show since 2008, when I did my first New York concert at Ars Nova. And Jason Deasy and L. Morgan Lee and James Jackson had sort of all been involved for a long, long time early on.
And for people who are just hearing about A Strange Loop for the first time, how would you describe it? The basic premise of the plot is it's about a theater usher named Usher who mm-hmm. is writing a musical theater production about an usher named Usher. And correct. He interacts throughout this process with the thoughts mm-hmm. in his head played by a amazing cast of people. He in the process, though, we also he also interacts with his family
who are also played by the actors who play the thoughts. So the thoughts sort of transform from character to character to character as he's sort of making his way through the writing of this musical that's about himself. And eventually, you know, he has sort of a self-realization at the end about himself. It's sort of profound.
So one thing I want to ask you about is when he interacts with his family, there's all these different aspects of his interactions with his family. And part of that, I think, is he's also interacting with fictionalized versions of his family as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. So there's early scenes where you're seeing his mom played by the whole ensemble. And then you'll see like a later scene where his mom is played by one of them, but in this sort of like sitcom sort of version of what his family would be like. And then later you see his mom played by a different thought. And then that mom sort of takes us into the final family scene that's like a little bit more serious.
Yeah. And in this, you portray the family. The family comes off as both really loving and supportive of Usher as he's pursuing his Theater Dreams in New York, but also having very bigoted views of him as a gay man.
Right.
And what I just noticed from the song, the way the songs are written, for example, periodically, or Usher's mother sings to him about her concerns about his gay lifestyle, is you still, even though she's saying all these bigoted things, you still portray her with a lot of compassion, I think, as a writer. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's part of the complexity of life that he and I wanted to sort of express, which is that someone can have very bigoted views, but they also can like love you, and that those two things are not necessarily in conflict. I mean, well, it can be in conflict, but like they sometimes can't be pulled apart from one another. And so I just wanted to sort of offer the audience a sort of just a complex portrayal of a mother's love for her son.
And you do it, I think, via the melody, because there's a part of Periodically where she's singing to him about how concerned she is about his gay lifestyle, but yet the melody you've chosen for those words is so beautiful. It's during at the very end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like sort of a repeating melody that is sort of very melodic and very sort of almost like a lullaby.
Yeah.
And I just thought that that was like an important thing to lead the audience with, is that like, I didn't want people to just get caught up on, oh, his like homophobic mother, how horrible she is. Cause I just think it's more complicated than that. And I wanted the music to sort of, to support the complexity of it.
I was there when I saw it, when I went to it at Playwrights Horizon. Your parents were in the audience.
Oh, how yeah, I forgot you were there that day. That's right.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was amazing because they had never seen any of my theater writing at like ever. And I was nervous about them coming because they're not like regular theater goer people at all. Like that's just not part of their life. And I was just worried they just wouldn't like it, or they wouldn't understand it, or that it would, you know what I mean? That like, that just as a piece of art, that they would just be like, what is this? But they were like so into it. And they sort of, that day that you came was amazing because they kind of like stood in the lobby and like this whole crowd like gathered around while my mom started sort of, and my dad sort of started talking about me. And like, and it was just kind of, it was like a really, crucial point, I think, in our relationship, because suddenly I like, it was like I came out again, but this time as an artist to them. And it was, and they were just, they were so proud and they were so impressed. And I think it like really was an important moment for us.
Did it lead to any conversations with them about your relationship?
Not really, because like, that's the thing that's always like tricky for me to sort of explain to people about the show, is that like, it's why I don't call it autobiographical, right? Because I did draw from personal experience, but I also made a lot of things up. And so there were things that they like recognized about, you know, our relationship, but they also could see that it was something else. And so there was nothing really to talk about other than like, they would go, oh, is that that, or is this that, or whatever about it. But like it, they didn't really care about anything else other than like, wow, our child made this thing. And it's like really amazing. And they loved looking at everybody being so engaged around them, and they were into it, and there were parts that they thought were funny or whatever, you know, and so it just was like, there wasn't like a deep family conversation that was needed that needed to happen between us. It just, they just were proud of me and of it.
It's funny. My mom, she's a novelist, and one of her, I think her first published novel was a fictionalized memoir called The War at Home. Mm-hmm. And when she wrote it, her mom was still alive. My grandmother was still alive. And in the novel, which is very autobiographical, you know, it's about her kind of crazy, abusive family, and her mom did a lot of speed and was charming, but also a very bad mom in many ways. And my grandmother was at the book party, and she was just like, please just punch. Like, I think partly it was because she could, because it was fictionalized memoirs as opposed to, you know, totally true memoir, she had that, there was that distance that let her be proud of her daughter, but also feel like a star.
Yeah, I mean, and there was, and I just, again, just because I did fictionalize quite a lot, and I'm like, and everything in the musical is from Usher's point of view, who's like a young person who has sort of a distorted sense of self. And so like, and also just of his family. So like, there's also an aspect by which it's not even really about them like that, because that all ultimately sort of fades away, especially toward the end when sort of the gospel play that he creates sort of disintegrates. And so for me, it's not, it ultimately does end up just being about him and not about anybody else, you know?
Were you embarrassed? Like, because there's a lot of sexual stuff in it. I'm not saying you should be embarrassed. I know I would be embarrassed to talk to, if my parents saw me, forget that it was me in the thing, just me having written something like that. Were you at all embarrassed by that? Or are you a more mature person than I am?
I don't know that I was embarrassed, but I definitely was just like not sure how they would take any of it. To the degree to which they would associate anything that was happening on stage with my own life, they then might like draw certain conclusions, which, as with everything else in the show, it's much more complicated than what you just see on stage. And so I just was thinking, I was just like not sure how they would take it, but I wasn't like embarrassed.
One of my favorite songs of yours is not in a strange loop. It's called Judith.
You said the industry will always be the industry. So I have given a fuck what others think about me. Whether I hit my mark or jump the shark or lose my spark when they doubt me, I will follow my Judith light through the darkness.
And it's about your struggles to break out in the musical theater industry. And really, it's a song for anybody who's struggling to express themselves and to be heard at a time when it feels the world doesn't want to hear them. And, you know, and it's just about your struggles. And the chorus is, the industry will always be the industry. And I've given up, given a fuck what they think about me. Right. So, and that was written well before A Strange Loop blew up into the most successful musical, most acclaimed musical on Broadway. So I'm just wondering your reflections now back on that song and the, you know, the frustrations you were feeling when you wrote it.
So the song Judith was one that came about because of the actress Judith Light, of whom it's named after. She's, if you've ever met her in real life, she's just a really incredible person. And she gave me like a me and the group of people I was with a really crucial bit of advice. We were all in sort of like a session of her. She sort of in some ways is like a life coach, which is kind of amazing. She does this thing where she like talks to artists about like their lives. And she came into the room and she sat down and she goes, I don't want to talk about the industry. Fuck the industry. The industry is the industry. She's like, tell me, you're all going to make it. Tell me about your lives. And then she like stares you in the eye and then she's like, what's going on? And she just like looks at you like, and she doesn't flinch. And she just, you start talking to her about things. And I was really inspired by listening to her talk to everyone and to me about, you know, people feeling struggles about where they were as writers or as people or whatever, or as artists. And I just started writing this song because I, at that time, definitely felt this sense of like, of not being where I wanted to be as an artist and wanting to do more. And so I wrote that song as just a way of sort of purging this idea that I had to fit into some sort of box or category. And so when I reflect back on it, what I feel is like that another artist inspired me to keep going. And that sort of advice really helped me over like a sort of crucial hurdle that then sort of opened things up for the success that was to come.
And what's so cool about your journey to me is you were uncompromising and sticking to your ethics and to your artistic voice. And your musical itself takes digs at the musical theater industry. And yet here you are now being totally embraced by it. And I imagine that's both a little uncomfortable, but also, I mean, it's got to be exhilarating.
Yeah, it's also sometimes confusing, because the thing that I've sort of learned is that people who love the show or hate the show or whatever, everyone projects onto it whatever they want. And I sort of have to like back away from what people's opinions of it are. It's in a way, it's a strange Luke. It's that like the very thing that I was sort of railing against was the thing that helped me sort of rise, which is sort of reminds me, you know, the piece sort of owes a big debt to the artist Liz Phair, who has a song off of her first album, Exile in Guyville, that says, "I'm asking sweet Mary, please temper my hatred with peace, weave my disgust into fame, and watch how fast they run to the flame." And that's has always been like a mantra of mine. And I feel like that's sort of what happened in a way with A Strange Loop.
What does that mean, what you just said? Like, what is that Liz, what do those Liz Phair lyrics mean to you? Which I grew up listening to her in high school. So,
well, what it means is that you sort of, you might start at the bottom of the food chain, but like the very thing that keeps you, that like that keeps you at the bottom is the thing that can propel you to the top. And I think that that's a big piece of what happened with A Strange Loop, is that like I was sort of an outsider in many, many ways. And my outsider status is the thing that I wrote about and from. And that ultimately ended up being the thing that people were most drawn to.
I saw that you and the cast were visited by Michelle Obama. what was that like? And have you been visited by people who you've been critical of? Either vocally or on Twitter.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing about it is that like I've actually gotten quite quiet over the last year, partly because not because of that, but because like I feel like the world has become so sort of tribalistic in its sort of culture war sort of stances. And I just have become more questioning of that and sort of more non-ideological than I've ever been in my life in that regard. And so I sort of, and also I got into like a sort of back and forth with somebody about a topic where I was like, I have two choices here. I can incinerate this person, which is very in my wheelhouse to like burn. I am actually a fire breathing dragon, or I can just totally shut the fuck up forever. And I decided to shut the fuck up forever because it's all just trying to drain you of your energy. And so what that meant is that like lots of things would happen in the world that I wanted to comment on, but I just decided I'm not gonna do it. So there are people who've come to the show who like I have been critical of, but in those moments, what I sort of have to do is just be gracious to them as a guest who's come to the house and they paid their money for a ticket or they got a ticket or whatever, and they're there, and it's not going to go beyond that. And so it's been a little strange on one level, because I know what I think of them or I know what critiques I've made in the past, but also like there they are shaking my hand and they've been moved by the piece that they've seen and I've written. And so I have to take that into consideration as well. And I just sort of leave it there. And it's sort of, you know, and I feel like there was a time in the world wherein you could have, you know, political disagreements with people without it turning into World War III. Whereas now we live in a time where everybody is like wanting to be the World War III they want to see in the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, I'm for big peace. Isn't that what Jimmy Dore always says? He's like for big peace.
Oh, right.
The big
even
piece.
Like real, even though he's like all super pugilistic about everything all the time. But we love Jimmy. That's sort of the compromise I've taken with that. Cause like Michelle Obama came to the show, Pete and Chastain came to the show. A lot of folks. I mean, and not just political people, but like, you know, culture, pop culture figures who like, I'm sort of like, Yeah, you know, like, I mean, I don't really, I mean, RuPaul's like into fracking or whatever, and RuPaul is one of our co-producers. So I don't know, like, there's, what am I going to say? Like, there's, in that moment, like, they're there, they're grateful to be there, I'm happy they're there.
Right.
It's not a moment when I would choose to, like, suddenly, like, start attacking them for some disagreement I have with them.
That's what's cool about art and music, is it transcends all of that, and it speaks to a human experience that is deeper than politics. Right. Whenever sometimes when I'm arguing with someone politically and I'm feeling angry towards them, one way I disengage is I imagine, well, maybe both of us have been moved by the same piece of music before. Mm-hmm. Music does have the power to do that, to move people who are bitterly opposed and maybe even hate each other. It does have the power to actually move both of us. And I think that's just an amazing thing about it.
Yeah, and I think another thing that I also have learned is that, like, sometimes when somebody's right there in front of you, you feel differently about them. Mm. Because most of the people who, like, I've been critical of, I've never met them, ever.
Right.
And so, like, when they're in front of you, it's like, oh, there's suddenly another human being standing in front of you. And you have to, like, you don't have any choice other than to, like, deal with whatever that makes you feel. And, like, maybe you still are like, oh, you're, like, you know, scum of the earth. I mean, I'm sure there are people who, like, if they came to the show, there's some people, like, if they came to the show, I would probably be like, I probably would, like, I don't want to meet them because I feel so strongly. But, like, the thing I just have been learning, because I've met so many people in general who come to the show who, like, tell me what it means to them, that it's forced me to be a lot more empathetic and a lot more just meeting somebody where they are in the moment and not projecting my own whatever on top of them, even if, like, I know we have disagreements. And that's also something that I've tried to do by inviting certain people to the show too, who, like, I know I might have disagreements with. And you know, and I know that might sound like, oh, I'm promoting civility, but, like, and fuck civility, you know, now, like, but that's sort of what I'm talking about, is that, like, I want peace, you know, and, like, this is a small way to promote it, I guess, you know. Who knows if that will work out in the long run, but I found it to be a profound way of sort of interacting in the world in this moment when everything is so fraught and so, you know, binary and so, like, my way or the highway.
I mean, I didn't expect you to tell Michelle Obama, like, get out of here, you neoliberal shill who's weaponized identity politics. But I was just wondering if there was, like, if it felt weird. And the other thing is, you didn't have a huge, I don't know if you've ever tweeted something about the Obamas.
But I definitely have.
You have. Okay. Yeah. But you also didn't have it. You didn't, and you still don't. I mean, I think I just saw you got to 15,000, which is great, Twitter followers, but it's also very possible that they'd have no idea.
Yeah. I'm sure they don't. I mean, they don't, and what do they care? Like, people have said, like, all kinds of things about them for years and years and years and years. So what is, like, you know, something I say matter to them at all? And again, in that moment, she, like, thanked me for the show and I thanked her for coming, and that was it. I didn't say anything beyond that. You know, I certainly don't.
You didn't say, yes, we can.
I didn't say, yes, we can. I didn't say, like, anything beyond thank you for coming. I appreciate you for being here, because I did appreciate her for being there. And, like, so many of the people in the room really, really love her. Like, and I just have to leave it at that, because there's just truly no value in me doing and going and taking it any further than that.
Aaron, you should, next time you're fighting, like, with Mark Townsend, who, you know, smeared you for having disinformation, you should just say, be like, Mark, what do you think of this song called Inner White Girl? Or what do you think of the song Judith?
I don't want to do that because I don't want to risk liking people like that. And if we bond over a strange loop, then I'm in trouble, because I've listened to it on loop.
Yeah.
I love it so much. Michael, in your Tony speech, you talked about when you wrote A Strange Loop, you wanted to create a life raft for yourself. And I'm wondering if now you think and have seen how you've actually created a life raft for many people who have really felt seen by this musical in ways that they weren't before.
Yeah, that's been kind of, that's sort of connected to what we were talking about before, that like so many people come up to me and said, you know, I felt seen by the show. It like this reflected some aspect of my life or my family. Or like this one guy came up to me and told me that, you know, his family had never really accepted him for being gay for many years. And then he like brought some of them to the show, and that the show sort of helped them start a dialogue in their family. And that's like, that was like really overwhelming for me to hear, because it's not that like I didn't think that something like that could happen, but that that's like a real thing that somebody said happened in their life as a result of, you know, watching this thing that I had spent all these years and years and years and years working on, and that I had started from a truly just for myself sort of place. So that means a lot to me. And I don't, and I think that that's significant. And it's why, like, you know, if there are people who, I mean, disagree with politically or culturally or whatever, if the show means something to them, I can't dismiss that totally. Like, I do think it's just like a human aspect, particularly with art, that like, that can just cut through quite a lot. I mean, it doesn't mean that like the disagreements are not still there, but that it's not nothing. And I've had to really sort of internalize that like those human to human moments are like really, really important. And I treasure them.
Are you able to tell us any stories without giving away any names or identities of your most frustrating interactions with industry types that might represent just how difficult and dysfunctional the musical theater world is, or the entertainment world is?
I think like the biggest frustrations that I've had are, they're not necessarily around like breaking through, but they're like, a big frustration I have is the director of A Strange Loop is Stephen Brackett, and he is white. And there's been over the years, even to Broadway, even with the success of the show, there are these people, these voices that come in and are like, why do you have a white director? How dare a white director direct this? A white director can't, a white director just, like, what's, somebody made you have a white director. You thought you needed a white director. And the sort of narrowness of that, the way that people talk about that completely ignorantly without understanding the history of how he came to be involved with the piece, or what his contributions had been, or how valuable his contributions had been, or what our collaboration is like, really, I find quite infuriating, because the implication in it, whether they say it or not, is that me, a Black musical theater writer, is like a baby who is incapable of making his own decisions or of having integrity to do whatever it is that he wants in his own work. It's that what becomes important is that there's a white person involved, and that they're sort of in charge of me or in charge of my musical. And so that's been a frustration of mine, because I always have to be like, motherfucker, shut the fuck up. Like, nobody tells me what to do, ever. I'm fully, fully capable of like making my own decisions and of collaborating with somebody, white, Black, brown, whatever. And I have done it my entire career. And so that's a big frustration, because it speaks to sort of that, the narrowness that so many people have in their minds, and the sort of like closet racism that they have. Even as they might think that them making that sort of judgment is somehow speaking truth to power, it's actually a kind of racism in and of itself, because it takes me out of the equation. So that's been, I would say, if I had to name any frustration, that's been like the biggest one. And it also, you know, disregards Stephen's work. And Stephen has, I feel, been one of the most respectful, one of the most patient and sort of like collaborative people that I've met. It doesn't mean that he's like been perfect the entire time, but like he's been like the most ideal collaborator that I could have had for this piece to date. So that's something that I feel strongly about.
Who are some of the people who you would not be able to talk to if they came to your show? And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. Well, that was great, huh?
That was awesome. So good to hear from Michael. I'm so happy for him and all of his success. It's amazing to see someone with so much talent and so uncompromising and so much independence making it to the top. I mean, he is the toast of the town right now. Doesn't happen very often, if ever. And it's amazing to see him succeed.
And guys, you're definitely going to want to become Substack subscribers. You get to hear Aaron nail one of his harassers. I'm not going to give away too much, but someone who has been very unfair, written a hit piece against Aaron. Aaron catches him on camera.
He calls him
and we have the videotape.
Yeah.
Well, thanks everyone for watching.
And for more, go to usefulidiots.substack.com.
Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.